I just have a hunch. And my hunch is that a lot more of this is metabolic than we previously thought. In college, we just chalked everything up to biomechanics. We just said, oh, you just broke down, you know, maybe it's your foot strike or whatever it is. Like, my co-founder, John, he was fourth in Foot Locker. He was leading with 100 to go in that. He was undefeated in the state of Colorado for years. And he came to college and he had 14 stress fractures. Is that because we were just running too much mileage, or was there something else, you know, kind of metabolic that was going on there? One of the things that we found is that the athletes who have this higher metabolic scope or PAL, physical activity level, as we call it, are the more injury prone ones. And that when you rank athletes on the same team, doing the same work with the same lean body mass, top to bottom in terms of their physical activity level, so the multiples of how many of their basal metabolic rate they're burning, it's the most injury prone to the least injury prone, top to bottom. And then, furthermore, if we calculate the time that you could sustain that theoretically based on the limits that have been published in the literature, we can calculate that sustainability time, and that is the interval on which these athletes appear to be getting injured, like eerily close. Again, we've tested people who are doing the same thing at the same lean body mass, right? And their calories are all over the place to the tune of 1,000 calories different, doing the same exact running. What we've noticed is that stress and anxiety matter, autoimmune can matter, everything else that it takes to be you adds into this. And so it's like mileage is like useful, but it's also a crude approximation for what we're really going for.
Hey guys, welcome to the Run Free podcast, where we discuss a variety of running topics using our holistic five principles. These principles provide the framework that we use every day at Run Free Training to create individualized training programs and guide athletes along their running journey. In addition to coaching, we offer a number of services, including an e-course, camps, and form analysis with a strength program built specifically for you. If you're interested in learning more about what we do, you can check us out at runfreetraining.com. Today's guest is Hari Mix from Calorify. Calorify is an at-home metabolic test that gives you an accurate reading on your caloric output, along with the body composition analysis and a hydration analysis. In this conversation, we go over Jay and I's test results, along with some general principles that we learned about metabolism and how we can use it to better inform our training. On a personal note, I think there was a lot of interesting information that came away from my test, more than I really thought that I would get out of it. And I'm excited to start to apply some of those principles to my training and see what kind of progress we can make. If you're interested in taking the test yourself, Calorify has given our listeners an amazing 50% discount on their product. You can use code RUNFREE at checkout, and that's RUNFREE, all caps. Hari, well, welcome to the podcast. Jay and I are super excited to have you guys on. You're obviously representing Calorify, your guys' business, where you're the CEO. So why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you and Calorify?
Absolutely. Well, first off, thank you for having me on. I have kind of, two aspects to my background. One is as a distance runner. I'm from Virginia. I was a good high school runner there and then moved on to Stanford. That's where I actually met Ryan Hall and became good teammates and friends. And I had a good career there, although it was cut a bit short. I'd say some of my top accomplishments there were being fifth in the Pac-10 in cross and being an All-American in the 5K in track. But I have ankylosing spondylitis. It's a type of autoimmune disease that ended my running career. Post-running, I moved on to a PhD program at Stanford. I'm an earth and climate scientist with an expertise in kind of studying oxygen and hydrogen isotopes, which is actually kind of the foundation of the technology that we've built here at Calorify. So I'm actually making the exact same measurements I used to make on snow samples and water samples and clay samples and other rock samples. And I'm actually doing it on urine samples now for the study of metabolism. So what we do at Calorify, we are the world's only way of measuring how many calories you actually burn. So you take a simple at-home urine test, you learn how many calories you're eating and burning, your body fat percentage, how much you're training, your hydration, and a bunch of other kind of related metrics. And we're really just excited to take these kind of out of the research world where they've been stuck for over four decades and kind of into the public sphere and into the hands of people who really need this information, such as endurance athletes. So that's kind of a little bit on me and the company. Founded the company with John McGuire, also a fellow Stanford runner. So we kind of have endurance and distance running kind of, you know, kind of in our DNA of the company.
That's awesome. That's super cool. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the test, because obviously, you know, that whole the isotope thing is how the test works. And I mean, I don't even understand the like how it works with rocks versus humans. And Jay and I have both done this test now. So what is the test? How does it work?
Right. So you're going to take a sip of this special water. It's literally water. There's nothing in the water, but we've labeled the hydrogen and oxygen on the water with rare forms of those elements called stable isotopes. So these are forms of hydrogen and oxygen that are heavier than the most common forms. They have extra neutrons in their nucleus. These are already naturally in your body right now. They're only about 0.2% of the hydrogen and oxygen in your body. And we're just going to spike them up to a larger level so that we can trace the hydrogen and oxygen through your body. So it's not actually having any effect on your body at all. It's totally passive. It's literally doing what water would do in your body. We're just tracing it through your body and out through your urine. And what we're really doing is we are trying to compare the rate that hydrogen and oxygen go through your body so that we can measure how much carbon dioxide you exhale. Mm. So if you've ever heard of a VO2 max test, or if you've ever done a VO2 max test, you know, you might hop on a treadmill or on an exercise bike, you're wearing a mask, and it's going to measure the amount of oxygen and carbon dioxide going in and out of that mask. And so that's how you get your VO2 max. That's how you learn how much fat or carb you're burning, your aerobic threshold, your anaerobic threshold, all that kind of cool stuff. We are the equivalent of wearing that mask 24/7 for a week. And so it's a much more zoomed out perspective than the type of metabolic testing that an athlete is usually used to. They're usually used to testing for, you know, what your performance is going to be, you know, as an endurance athlete. We're much more zoomed out and looking at your body like a budget. How big is my paycheck and how am I spending it? So we're trying to figure out how many calories do you burn each day over the course of that week? And we do that again by measuring the amount of CO2 that you produce. So think about the urine test that we give you as a sensor hooked up to the tailpipe of a car. Based on the amount of exhaust coming out that tailpipe, we can measure how much gasoline you're burning. So we're measuring your gas mileage. We're measuring the rate at which you burn fuel. It's a fundamental aspect of who you are as a human being. Metabolism is the sum of all of the chemical reactions that are life-sustaining in your body. You have 37 trillion cells. So it's the energy that's required to power all those cells, to do all the things you need to do to be a human and to be an athlete. And so we measure them from this 30,000-foot view of basically how much energy do you bring into your body, and then how do you spend that energy once you have it.
Nice. That's cool. Yeah. I remember hearing somebody ask a question, like, how do you lose weight? Like, what happens when you're trying to lose weight through exercise? And like, there's some videos watching and nobody knew the answer. Right. But it's, right. It is essentially losing CO2 and sweat, right? It's like what we're exhaling and what we're sweating out is essentially like the decomposition of fat. So that's essentially,
You pee it out too. Absolutely. Yeah. So that there's the overlying kind of concept of energy balance, the calories in, calories out. That is kind of the fundamental equation. If we think about it in terms of fat and fat balance, so I think there are a lot of misconceptions about that. So fat is always being created and destroyed. So think about like I've heard the analogy before of thinking about a room with people in the room, and some people are walking in the entrance and some people are walking out the exit. So there's always people walking in and there's always people walking out. But the amount of fat that you have, the amount of people in that room is going to be the difference in the rate between how many are walking in and how many are walking out. So that's what's happening when you exercise. You are you're probably increasing the amount of fat that you're burning. Now, on the energy intake side, you can eat fats, carbs, protein, all kinds of different macronutrients, right? But let's say that you're eating a really high fat diet. So you have a lot more fat being stored and you're also burning a lot more fat. Let's say you're eating all carbs, no fat. Well, you're not really creating that much fat, but you're also not really burning that much fat either. You're burning a lot of carbs. Hmm. And so all of this kind of smears out. And what ends up mattering in the long run is how much energy is coming in versus how much energy is going out. Calories in, calories out. That perfectly explains weight. That's been shown over and over and over again in rigorous clinical settings. So they can lock people in what's called a metabolic chamber, where they measure the oxygen and CO2 going in and out of a room. So again, that VO2 max mask analogy, but now the mask is the entire room. So they can exactly measure how much people are burning, and then they can exactly measure how much they're feeding them in this hospital food jail, basically. And calories perfectly explain weight. Now, we know there's a lot more to life and a lot more to athletics than weight. So there's body composition, you know, how much body fat you have versus lean mass, like muscle, bone, organ, and all that. And so it gets more complicated when you want to talk about body composition, and especially when you want to talk about athletic performance. But calories explain weight, and then they play a really, really major role in body composition and athletic performance as well. They're not the whole picture. There's a lot more to the world than calories, but ignoring calories is a mistake.
Yeah. And I feel like that's something that gets debated a lot. Like people say it's either calories in, calories out, or it's like a lot more nuanced, which my understanding of it is it gets really interesting in the calories out aspect of it, right? Which is also, I think, a huge component of what you guys are looking into and what, you know, I think what needs to be considered more. So you suggested that I read a book by Herman Ponser, Burn, that was kind of talking about doing a lot of different testing using this method. So tell us a little bit about Herman Ponser, who he is with Calorify, and also, you know, getting into a little bit of what that research was looking into.
Absolutely. So Dr. Herman Ponser is a full professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University. He's held a variety of university appointments before that. He did his PhD at Harvard with Dan Lieberman, who you may know in the running world as all the barefoot running stuff. Mm. So that all came out of that lab, and he was a PhD student in that lab, and he made contributions to that. So he's done a variety of studies of, you know, human evolution, the origin of bipedalism, barefoot running, obesity, spoiler alert. The speed of your metabolism doesn't affect obesity. People with obesity don't have slow metabolisms. Metabolism over the course of your life. Spoiler alert, your metabolism doesn't slow down like when you have kids or anything like that. It does slow down as you age after about 60. And he's done a lot of work at metabolism at the extremes. So looking at essentially the world records of energy expenditure and energy intake. What is possible for the human to do? So he's tested people who have run across America or set the Arizona Trail speed record. Some guy ran it in, I believe, 8 days, ran from Mexico to Utah. It's about 100 miles a day, something like that. Oh. 80, 90 miles a day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he's done a lot of work studying like the limits of what's possible to burn, basically. He also has some really interesting studies of what he calls the constrained energy model. There are a lot of people who I would have counted myself in this group before founding the company, conceive of exercise as adding on top of non-exercise calories. So say that you're burning 2,500 calories a day, and you go for a run, and your Garmin tells you that you burned 500 calories on the run. Most people would assume that you burn 3,000 calories that day, that you can eat an extra 500 because you ran 500. And that's not true. He's shown that really elegantly, that the more that you exercise, the more that it decreases non-exercise calories to a point. This doesn't work infinitely, but at moderate levels, it does. Maybe when you go for that long run, and you might have noticed this, maybe you fidget less that day. Maybe you're kind of sitting on the couch more. So your body finds ways to basically stay in this kind of homeostasis, in this equilibrium. The neatest study with this was he studied hunter-gatherers in East Africa at a group called the Hadza. They walk about 10 kilometers a day, and they burn the same amount of calories as sedentary Americans, once you correct for lean body mass. So it's actually pretty interesting that you can be pretty active and still not burn that many more calories. So the kind of one of the takeaways here is, you know, don't look at your wearable for calories. If you're using an activity tracker or a smartwatch, just know that maybe it's getting the exercise piece right, but it's not giving you total calories accurately at all. It's been shown over and over again that it's about 50% accurate compared to our data. So it can be off by thousands of calories if you trust what your Apple Watch or your Garmin or anything like that says. And yeah, generally speaking, exercise isn't as good for weight loss as people think. And I think a lot of us kind of know that intuitively. It's very hard to out-exercise a bad diet. So for most people, maybe not the top pro athletes, but for most people, it's easier to achieve their goals in the kitchen as opposed to, you know, on the treadmill or something. So we approached him immediately, John and I, after founding the company. I drove down to Duke and pitched him and brought him on board as our scientific advisor right away. He's absolutely the right person to do this. He's a world expert in the method that we use, the method that I was mentioning earlier this urine test. It's called doubly labeled water. And that's how Herman has accomplished a lot of these incredible research achievements of his. So he's just a really outstanding resource for us and someone that we rely on a lot to kind of translate our science.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I thought that book was super interesting to just think about like the context of who we are as humans and our evolutionary history, right? Where it's like we're trying to manipulate our diets for certain, you know, goals and outcomes, but we're also operating in this long history and we kind of have to account for that. And I know I've certainly seen that in my own like athletic history. When I was a cyclist, there was times where I was exercising so much and trying to limit my diet, and I was like gaining weight and I couldn't figure out what was happening. And, you know, experienced like a lot of like low energy. And I'm sure people who've trained hard will totally understand how that feels. And looking back, you know, I think some of this stuff makes a lot of sense in retrospect. Is like I was definitely down-regulating certain parts of my body to account for the like huge amount of output that I was trying to do and not supporting it with nutrition as well as I should have. So yeah, I want to get into that a little bit, because I think this is sort of, in terms of what Herman's research was showing, you know, it's showing this sort of like complex nature of calories out versus like how our body regulates that. So what are like the limits on metabolism that your body will go through to keep it within a certain range?
Gotcha. So let's see here. On the low end, you have a basal metabolic rate. So that is the energy it takes to keep the lights on. You know, if you think about the core things that your body has to do all the time to stay alive, it would be you have to thermoregulate, you have to keep your brain on, you have to pump blood, you have to breathe. So, you know, you have some basic functions that are required of you. And at Calorify, we calculate that for people based on their lean body mass. We make a very accurate measurement of that. So for most people, that's maybe somewhere between 1300 and 2000 calories, depending on their body size. It really depends on how much lean body mass you have. So that's what you need to basically stay alive. And if you go underneath that, even if you're at complete rest, you're going to be eating into that. You know, if your paycheck isn't big enough, you're going to be going into debt. You're going to lose weight. You're going to probably underperform in certain areas. Maybe it's your hormones. You know, for women, maybe it's losing your period. Maybe it's bone density. Maybe it's your brain function. I mean, it could be all these kind of things. But there is a minimum amount of nutrition that you need to be a healthy human being. And we refer to this concept as energy availability sometimes for athletes, and we'll go into that. But that speaks to like red S and all these overtraining syndromes that people have. And then on the upper end, if you think about it, the ceiling on how much metabolic work you can do is going to be how much nutrition can you get into your body? There's a finite amount that you can eat. And even if you can force feed over a certain amount, there's a finite amount that you can absorb through your gut. So there is a ceiling there. We don't know exactly where that is, but we've measured a bunch of people in a bunch of extreme situations. Think Tour de France, Western States 100, Ironman World Championships, these types of events. And what happens in these big events is that people lose weight. They're not able to get enough calories on board. And so from there, we can calculate how much basically their ceiling is. And that ceiling turns out to be around 2.5 times your basal metabolic rate. We don't know exactly where it is. We bet that it varies from individual to individual, but that's around where it is. So you can basically bet that if you're burning more than around there, you're going to either not sustain that level of activity after a while, either through getting sick or injured or simply dialing back or tapering for your race or taking time off for the holidays or whatever, or you're going to lose weight. You will lose weight until you kind of come back down into that kind of sustainable zone. So basically, it's somewhere between 1 times your basal metabolic rate and 2.5 times your basal metabolic rate. And we know that for temporary periods of time, you can exceed those thresholds. We know that people fast for an extended period of time. They're eating less than 1 BMR, but they will lose weight. We know that people can burn more than 2.5 times their BMR, but we know they're not eating more than it, too much more than it. I think the world record for eating that I've found in the literature is Tour de France. They fed them 4.5 times their BMR.
Whoa.
Which is so much food. So much food. So imagine for a 150-pound rider, that's probably something like 7,000 calories a day that they actually got into their bodies.
Yeah.
But they only could do that for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And they were destroyed, right? So
Hari, I've got a question about that. So as you get in better shape and as you train more and improve, how does your basal metabolic rate and how does your ceiling change or does it?
So this is an example of like awesome questions that we want to solve at Chlorify just by simply testing athletes who are at the extremes. The evidence that we have so far is kind of anecdotal. And I would say that there isn't any evidence that you can train your metabolism to change your BMR or to change your ceiling all that much. Now, there are reasons that those things change. So let me explain what those are. Your BMR can change. There's a bad phenomenon, usually thought of as bad, called metabolic adaptation, which is where your metabolism will slow down. It'll kind of turn down the thermostat if you've been in too long of a calorie deficit for too long. So your body's basically like kind of conserving energy, right? And so if you have a BMR that you measure in the lab that's significantly lower than what we would predict based on our test, then maybe that's a sign that you've actually been in an unhealthy calorie deficit or something like that, kind of crash dieting or whatnot. Your BMR can also be higher than we would predict based on our test. And maybe that's from anxiety or stress, something like that. So neither of these are great reasons, but your BMR can turn up or turn down. Your body will change it. And the best way to get that test done is in the lab. It's called resting metabolic rate. They hook you up and they have you lie on a table and you just wear a mask and you breathe into it for like 15 minutes. And they'll tell you basically how many calories you're burning at rest. But we don't know the answer to that ceiling and if you can change it. Like, it's a really interesting question. Have we measured the Usain Bolt of metabolism? Like, what would you guess? Like, do you think Kipchoge can sustain 3 times his BMR and that's why he's able to be this consistent for this long? I mean, decades of training at this volume? Or is he totally staying within the bounds of limits for him because he's so efficient and he's so good at recovery and he's fueling correctly and all these other things? Like, these are awesome questions that we want to solve and we are trying to solve by working with some of the world's top athletes.
Yeah, I think that'd be super interesting to know that information because something that I do with my athletes a lot is try to put more focus on consistency rather than these like you know, microcycles of training. And I think maybe same thing with the dietary stuff too. It's like, if you're in that 2.5 times your basal metabolic range consistently, and you're kind of at the top end of it, rather than doing this like up and down, going way over, which I think I've definitely done that. Like, are the best guys in the world just doing that, right? Because even, you know, say guys like the Ingebrigtsens, like, yep. Like they're kind of changing the paradigm on what it means to train well, right? Like maybe knocking down the effort level a bit, but doing it consistently in higher volume. And I think maybe same thing with dietary stuff, where it's like, maybe it's not about getting to those super extremes, but just staying, you know, right on that edge.
Yeah, absolutely. We're working with Team Boss right now, you know, top women's professional group out of Boulder. And that's their basic, you know, kind of thesis is the consistency piece. And that's the part that we're trying to help them with the most.
Yeah.
You know, from an athlete and from a coaching standpoint, that consistency piece, if that is what ends up being the takeaway from Team Boss and Ingebrigtsens and, you know, Kipchoge and everybody, and that's like the real way we do it, it's no wonder that it's not been done as much, because how hard is it as an athlete and a coach to reach a new level and just have that desire to just go for a little bit more and push a little bit harder? I mean, that's just the nature of us as motivated people, is we want to see what that limit is, but maybe we don't need to go quite to that limit. Maybe we need to just get up there and stay there.
Absolutely. I'm right there with you. I just have a hunch. And my hunch is that a lot more of this is metabolic than we previously thought. In college, we just chalked everything up to biomechanics. We just said, oh, you just broke down, you know, maybe it's your foot strike or whatever it is. Like, you know, my co-founder, John McGuire, he was extremely talented. He was fourth in Foot Locker. He was leading with 100 to go in that. He was undefeated in the state of Colorado for years. And he came to college and he had 14 stress fractures. No. So like, is that mechanics? Is that because we were just running too much mileage, or was there something else, you know, kind of metabolic that was going on there? We won't know, but I think that one of the things that we found is that the athletes who have this higher metabolic scope or PAL, physical activity level, as we call it, are the more injury prone ones. And that when you rank athletes on the same team doing the same work with the same lean body mass, top to bottom in terms of their physical activity level, so the multiples of how many of their basal metabolic rate they're burning, be it 2.5 or whatever it is, it's the most injury prone to the least injury prone, top to bottom. And then furthermore, if we calculate the time at which the time that you could sustain that theoretically based on the limits that have been published in the literature, which are by no means complete, there's limited data. Like, there needs to be more data on this, and we want to build more data at Calorify. We can calculate that sustainability time, and that is the interval on which these athletes appear to be getting injured, like eerily close. So like, you know, somebody's breaking down two or three times a year, and we're predicting that that's the interval, you know, at which they would need to drop back under that 2.5. We don't believe the 2.5 is a magic number. 2.5 times your basal metabolic rate is kind of an arbitrary idea, but there has to be a limit. We imagine that people do have different limits. We know it might not be 2.5. Is it 3 for some elites? We've measured plenty of elite runners at like 3, for example, but maybe they kind of taper or they come back down. You know, or maybe they take time off, or maybe they do get sick or injured, but it's probably not 4. It's actually certainly not 4. And the reason why is that Tour de France riders are at like 4.9. So if you could train at 4 all year long, then you would just win the Tour, and then you would just win every other bike race. Like, if you could live at 4, then you just would be running 250 miles a week, and you just would be better than everybody else. So it's just, we know there has to be a ceiling. And we know the neighborhood of that ceiling for people.
So Hari, just to clarify for people that haven't taken this test, when you're talking measuring 2.5 times basal metabolic rate, can you talk about like the specifics of how you're getting that number?
Yeah, absolutely. And let's put some real numbers to it. I could use your numbers if you'd like.
Sure.
Yeah. So you were burning 4,369 calories per day.
Oh, Jay. Jeez, man.
But you're also a bigger guy and you're quite lean. And you said you were running what, over 50 miles a week? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an unreasonable amount. We measure people that are burning over 4,000 calories a day all the time. And in fact, we measure plenty of people that are burning 5,500 calories a day. We've measured up to 6,600 calories a day here at the lab. So then your basal metabolic rate, you have 138.9 pounds of lean body mass. And that translates to a basal metabolic rate of 1669. So if you're just to lie stationary on a table just to breathe, pump blood, keep your brain on, keep your core body temperature 98.6 or whatever, you need 1669 calories per day. So this number is 4,369, your total, divided by your basal metabolic rate, 1669. And that comes out to 2.62. So you're right there around that limit, in the vicinity of the limit, where if you were to run more or do other work outside of running, more grocery shopping, running up and down more stairs, picking up the kids, whatever it is, you would either be on borrowed time. Maybe you could sustain it for 200 days, but then you're going to take a month down, whatever. You're going to go on a holiday and veg out, whatever it is. Or you're going to lose weight.
Yeah. So that week that I did, and basically you're measuring that week from when I drank the magic water to the last time I peed. Yeah. The magic water.
That's right. Magic water.
Days. So, hey, that 7 days, I also lifted every day an hour.
Yeah.
And basically, it's summer, so my kids are home. So every day when I get home, we're either swimming, biking, playing basketball. Like it's, you know, usually my summers are like end zone to end zone. Like I go pretty hard in the summer. But now the 2.6, that's how much I am requiring to not lose weight.
And did you lose weight that week, Jay? Or did
no,
you?
No, I did not. So in the thing, I gained a pound that week, 1 pound. But I was telling Hari, I haven't gained weight in like 10 years. So I'm clearly, hopefully from now on, I'm not going to gain a pound a week. But no, yeah. I think you said there was some data there in the water weight and whatever that could be accounting for that.
Yeah. So, I mean, we know what you're burning. You're burning 4,369. You know, there's some error on that, maybe 100 calories, not a ton, maybe 150. It's pretty tight measurement. So just, you know, first finding, you need to be getting around 4,400 calories a day to maintain your weight. That's just your nutritional need for doing what you did that week. So that first and foremost, if you are an endurance athlete, you know, you're going to want to know how much fuel you need to correctly, you know, fuel your training. You know, it's interesting. I think there's a somewhat of a mindset in distance running. We know that weight matters and we know that body composition matters and stuff like that. And so there's oftentimes a focus on being light or having a race weight or whatever it is. So the question shouldn't be, how little can I eat? The question should be, how much can I eat? Because that's what's going to allow you to actually train and recover and do all the things that you need to do to improve as an athlete. And so then the question becomes, well, how much nutrition can I get on board? And for you, Jay, we guesstimate that there's not much more that you could eat, even if you started to force feed. And by the way, you kind of already figured this out. Like you haven't been able to gain weight. So if for the amount that you're burning right now, it's going to be very hard to bring additional calories on board. That's the situation that a lot of top athletes are in, or serious amateurs like yourself. Like, you're probably near your nutritional ceiling. And so that's when you need to maybe start to transition into being a little bit more aware of your training volume. Most people, you know, the average physical activity level is about 1.6. You know, for me, that's about, you know, 3 dog walks a week, maybe lifting weights once or twice. That's about a 1.6, 1.7. For somebody like that, it's a lot easier for them to overeat and gain weight that way. And so it's a much easier knob for them to turn to focus on the nutrition side than the training side. For somebody who's already at this, you know, the level that you guys are in your training, it's you're riding that line a lot tighter, and that's where we need to focus on the training side a little bit more. And that's what we've noticed with like NBA players, for example. I mean, they're already working so hard that there's only so much more nutrition they can get on board. Why don't we think about it this way? Okay, so if you are in that kind of energy limited kind of, you know, state because you are working so hard, make sure that you do maximize your paycheck. Maybe that's where we start thinking about things like gut health, you know, like and really making sure that your diet is dialed so that you have the nutrition that you need. And then on the spending side, let's think about, well, I want to maximize my training. So what else can I do to maximize my recovery, to minimize my stress, my anxiety, minimize my autoimmune issue, minimize the other work that I'm doing that day, being on my feet or, you know, doing other strenuous activity, so that I can basically maximize my spending towards my training. And so what we're really trying to do is be this like budgeting app for top athletes and basically help them identify, you know, how big their paycheck is, see if they can make their paycheck any bigger. And then in terms of their spending, make sure that they're spending intentionally on the things that they want to spend on and cutting back on areas that they don't care about as much.
And then you can pull those levers of intensity, duration, mode of training, all of those things, and adjust them basically to get your 2.5 times basal metabolic rate down some weeks and up other weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, maybe it's not 2.5. I wouldn't ring the alarm bells for you at 2.62. Maybe this is totally fine. And maybe you do just have a couple easy weeks for the holidays. You know, this very well could be sustainable for you. I don't know. But when we see people well in excess of 3, we start to say, hey, this is, you know, you're probably burning, and we can calculate that number of calories for you. So we can say you're probably burning about 600 calories more than is sustainable right now for you and your body weight and all that.
How long do you think people can be in whatever their upper limit is? Do you say like Tour de France is 3 weeks? Is that about what you're saying?
Yeah, that's the world record for 3 weeks. So, you know, until proven otherwise, those guys are capable of burning more calories than you for 3 weeks. It's somewhere in that neighborhood. So there is a, you know, there's a curve I can actually show you here that will kind of illuminate this. So this is from Herman's book. This is the curve that I'm talking about. So in an Ironman triathlon, people burn about 9.5 times their BMR. There's some major scatter on any of these, but yeah, Tour de France, about 4.9. Race across the USA, they were running about 22 miles a day. Pregnancy is also really high, about 2.1 or 2.2. We've actually measured some top, athletes and non-athletes who are, pregnant or lactating, and they're all really high energy expenditures because they are, you know, nourishing their baby. So we can basically plot where you are on this graph and then calculate how many days that is for you.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's rough. Like, there's not enough data. And again, there's no reason to believe that any one of those people is, you know, like I said earlier, the Usain Bolt of metabolism. Like, there might be somebody who really is off this chart, but I can almost guarantee you they're not off this chart by one BMR or something like that. If they were, they would just probably just set all the world records for because it would just be so easy for them to ride the Tour de France that they would just, that would be their typical training volume. And then they would just win everything. Again, you know, there's a reason that I think that people haven't reached 250 miles a week, you know, as elite, like distance or middle distance runners. It's probably somewhere between where they are and where in 250 as to where people can go.
All right. Yeah. So I got to see Chad's now.
Yeah. So to preface this real fast, I think this is actually gonna be really cool to compare and contrast Jay and I's data, because they're very different for one. And also I think it shows like different lifestyle, different goals. But I think it's gonna be counterintuitive to kind of hear how that all plays out. And I'll have some insight into like what my week looked like. And I think some of the nuance is there, but just to give a general overview, this was one of my last big weeks before the Boston Marathon. So I ran like 100 miles. I had two big days in there. But let's just say like I was fatigued. I was tired at points in this week. So yeah. So Hari, if you want to pull up my stuff, that'd be cool.
Yeah. So Jeff, I will just say this. I was surprised. I would have thought you'd be burning more calories than you were.
Yeah.
It says here you're burning 3,058. You're not a big guy. So if we take a look at, you know, you have 117 pounds of lean body mass, meaning that your basal metabolic rate is 1538. So you are smaller than Jay. So your numbers do need to, you know, be down a little bit compared to his.
But that's and that's also not terribly, you know, like 100 and some odd calories, right? Like not a huge difference. Yeah.
Not as much as I would have guessed. So because of that, your physical activity level is 1.99, which is in a great place to be as a top athlete. We see a lot of top athletes in that 1.9 to 2.1, 2.2 kind of range that are like really durable. Like they're like, yeah, this was a solid week, but this wasn't anything crazy. So my guess is that, you know, you were doing a really, really good job of not spending elsewhere outside of your training allocation, because that's really kind of the only explanation I can think of. You know, there's not too many calories left over after you do all that running. And so you really were not burning that much outside of your training.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. I think that this was really interesting for me on a number of components. For one, I think, like we've kind of been talking about, using this metabolic range is a metric to influence like our training and how we're going about it, right? So I think for one, it was cool to see that there's some more room there to grow, right? And to speak back to what we were talking about in terms of fueling that too, because I did lose just like a little bit of weight this week as well. So I was even undercutting, you know, that lower amount of burn rate that I had anyways, right? So I'm eating under 3,000 calories. So to me, for one, I saw, okay, I can do more work and probably have more energy throughout my day as well if I'm like fueling better as well.
So I can actually put numbers to that. So you're at 1.99. So let's say that your ceiling is 2.5, could be anywhere in that vicinity. And your BMR is 1538. So you've got 0.51 of a BMR of times 1538. So you've got 784 calories to play with in your budget. You have a surplus if you choose to have one. You can either put on weight, like you can try to put on lean body mass while you're at this volume, or you can run more, or you can do more non-running activity. You know, you've got options in your budget there. You've got some wiggle room.
Yeah.
We can do the same for people who are over that limit. So we can take somebody who's at a 3.2 and we can say, look, you need to cut about 5 miles a day of running or equivalent energy expenditure somewhere else in your day. So we happily do that for people. Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of want to talk a little bit about what that week looked like for me, and where I think actually this gave me some good insight and gave me some good lessons to take moving forward. For one, so I kind of bookended this week with a Boston simulation that was like 6 miles at like negative 0.8% or something. So I did 6 miles down, 6 miles up, 6 miles down. So 18 miles of like hard running. I think I averaged like 4:55 pace or something on that one. And I even had like, I think 30 miles total on the day, lifted, like really massive day at the beginning. And then I had in and out miles at the end of the week, which is like 15 miles at like 5:10 average and like sub, like 4:55 pace or something for the on miles. So like big workouts on both end of the week, yeah. Low energy, kind of struggling midweek through the middle of that one. So during that week, I definitely felt like my energy was not great. So I was my everything else, right? Like I do a lot of work on the computer, but I was staying pretty static outside of that. Like my activity level outside of training was pretty minimal. And I think you can see that obviously like with the burn rate, right? So I think, you know, if you just had somebody look at Jay and I's Stravas, right, and said this guy ran 100 miles and was like crushing some marathon prep, you'd think that my burn rate was probably off the charts. But you know, you actually see the data and Jay's burning much more calories than I am. And I think that's cool to take in the whole context of what your whole life looks like. And, you know, I think as elite athletes, we get trained very well. And I think our bodies even go through this process of like, you're talking about fidgeting, and like Huberman will talk about how many calories you burn just by fidgeting. Right. But I am like, I'm a low energy, calm person outside of training. Right. So I think my body is really adapted to that, where it's like, we're going to take the overall burn rate like way down to accommodate for the training.
Again, we've tested people who are doing the same thing at the same lean body mass, right? And their calories are all over the place to the tune of 1,000 calories different, doing the same exact, you know, running. So what we've noticed is that stress and anxiety matter. That can be a big one. Autoimmune can matter. And then there's just other, all the other crap in your life can matter. Everything else that it takes to be you adds into this. And so it's like mileage is like useful, but it's also a crude approximation for what we're really going for. There's another thing I want to bring up, which is, do you have like Garmin data for like all your exercise calories?
Yeah. And that was something that I definitely, that was big, because even like my Garmin estimates my basal metabolic rate at like 1800. That's what it gives me for that. And then it's like everything on top of that was way more than what, you know, the data that we got from the test. So that was, I mean, if you think about that, even just the basal metabolic rate being off by that much, that's huge, right? Like that's like, if you're trying to lose a pound a week, you're not going to get anywhere close to that just with that discrepancy.
So the reason for that is that the Garmin is going to take your age, height, weight, and sex. And we're going to measure your body composition, and we're going to actually measure your lean body mass. And so you're not, I'm just looking at you, you're not the average person of your age, height, weight, and sex. We know that. So the further you are from the average, the worse it's going to be. But the reason I bring up exercise calories is there's this other concept, which is closely related to all this stuff we've been talking about physical activity level and limits and all that. And that's the concept of energy availability. So energy availability is how many non-exercise calories you have left after, you know, so it's calories eaten minus exercise calories. And it's expressed per kilogram of lean body mass. And this number is the number that they kind of benchmark all of the overtraining syndromes, like RED S. So relative energy deficiency in sport, used to be thought of as female athlete triad. So those three would be, you know, disordered eating, amenorrhea, so not having your period, and osteopenia, like bone density issues. But now it's known that males have the same problems, you know, similar types of hormonal and other overtraining type problems. And it's been shown in the literature that you need 30 calories per kilogram of lean body mass, non-exercise calories left to do all the things that you need to be healthy. And so we can calculate that for people if they have exercise calorie data from their watch or whatever. We can basically figure out how much of your paycheck do you have left over. And so we've done this on people, and you know, we've happily shown people, wow, like you actually have a lot in reserve here. You're like, you're in a great state where you have a lot of energy availability, so that you're not at risk of overtraining. So that is like the key one. And it's really important for endurance athletes to know this, because they're probably the most susceptible to it, that this is a bad injury if you get it. This is like a 6 to 12 month type problem. This can really, you know, we have had multiple friends and teammates deal with it, even Olympians. So, you know, overtraining is a really big deal, and we can get at it from multiple angles. We can try to get at it with this physical activity level thing. We can try to get at it with this energy availability thing, and at least provide you some tools to interpret, you know, what you're doing in training. This will help kind of us triangulate like what the issue is. Like if you are going into debt, don't you want to know what you're going into debt because of? So we can try to help you get to the bottom of it.
Yeah. So that would be, I feel like if you were doing that chronically, if you have this huge discrepancy, that would show up on this week-long test, right? I feel like what happened to me is on like these micro scales, I think from like a day-to-day thing, I had a lot of fluctuation there. Mm-hmm. Whereas say like, I would imagine that Jay was probably more consistent day-to-day because his is coming from more of like a lifestyle thing, right? Like running 50 miles a week, you're probably not having any really huge mileage days. So how do you get into the nuance of like the day-to-day fluctuation? Because I think that what happened for me on that week was I think I had a couple days that were like really massive burn rates that I probably didn't fuel enough, because I was also trying to lose a little bit of weight at that period of time. So like, say if you're running, like if I had a 30-mile day with weightlifting in there and there's a certain amount of calories that your body can even absorb, like on those days, should I just be like trying to maximize that as much as possible?
I think the good news is that if you zoom out far enough, none of it really matters. Like I understand that you probably need to fuel for a particular workout, or if you're doing a 30-mile day, like you're going to have specific nutritional needs to get through those workouts. But aside from that, just in terms of getting your overall calories in, I feel like if you get them in over the course of a week, I think you're fine. That's just my guess.
Okay. So you don't think
in terms of measuring it, it's really cool. It's really, really hard. The reason why we space things out over the course of a week is that we're trying to calculate these slopes, and that the further away things are, the more accurate they become. If there's an error on either of these things, the closer that they get to each other, the more error there is in that slope. And so the answer to the question of how much did I burn on Monday versus Tuesday versus Wednesday is going to have more error associated with it than the answer of how much did I burn that week. People have tried to do this. They've actually done like daytime and nighttime samples for like Tour de France riders and stuff like that, and tried to get how many calories they can burn overnight versus during the day and the stages and stuff. So I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it's extremely challenging to do technically. We can try to work with people on that, but it would be well above and beyond our normal service.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think so you think that as long as you're kind of taking care of the larger scale, say your entire week's nutrition, that should stabilize it, as opposed to, so say what happens if you get a day completely wrong? Like say on that day, what if my calorie deficit was like, you know, 1500 calories or something, you know, pretty big.
Yeah. Well, I'm not an expert on the exercise metabolism side, but are you, let's say that you like run out of glycogen. then what are you going to have to use? You're going to be able to use fat, but you're not going to be able to oxidize that fat as fast. So you might have to slow down, like your performance during that workout might suffer. You might also end up losing some muscle, where your body's going to break that down for energy too. So those would be my guesses.
You're not going to experience any like we're talking about these sort of like negative metabolic effects from like the something that small, right?
I don't believe so. I think that everything that we're talking about, you know, on our side is much more like kind of chronic. It's much more long term.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things for me as I listen to Chad and think about like completely different weeks, right? And this is something we talk about with Run Free athletes a lot. You know, comparison is really the thief of joy. So I yep. think a big mistake that a lot of us make is, you know, when I go to Flagstaff this summer and I'm hanging out with Chad, it doesn't really matter what he eats. And it doesn't really matter what I do. It's got to be, we've got to know ourselves as individuals. And Hari, I think that's the whole point of what you're alluding to. Is we've got to pay attention to who we are and not try to look at what somebody else is doing. On the other side, Chad, if you're trying to lose a pound and you're eating what I'm eating, dude, you're going to get really fat. So, and if I ate 3,000 calories that week, Hari, my assumption would be that I'm going to be under fueling and probably going to feel even worse.
Yeah. So a couple things there. Your final point. Yeah, I think you would under fuel, and based on some rough calorie math, I think you would lose about 1 pound in a week if you ate what Chad eats. So it's around 3,500 calories per pound of fat. It doesn't work out perfectly like that, and it's not linear, but yeah, it's something like that. So if you'd be eating 1,300 fewer calories per day than you're burning, yeah, you'd probably lose a pound. But yeah, no, to your point of like comparison, I couldn't agree more. One just kind of classic thing, everybody has these, you know, deeply ingrained beliefs because we all see them in like the checkout line at the supermarket, you know, like fast metabolism, slow metabolism. A, just know that none of those articles, anybody ever measured anything. We're the only commercial lab in the world. and number two, there's no evidence that having a fast or slow metabolism is correlated to outcomes. It doesn't have to do with obesity. Obese people do not have slower metabolisms. In fact, they have faster ones, but if you correct for lean body mass, they have the same speed. It's just about energy balance. It's just about the amount that they're eating and the amount that they're burning. That's all that it is. So when we see people with, you know, a slow metabolism, it's usually one of two things. One, they're a small person, so they have a low BMR. Just they're smaller, so they have a slower metabolism. And number two, it's the activity level, right? It's, are you getting out and moving? And so what we would say for a typical person is, hey, you probably want to like be at least like, I don't know, 1.5, 1.6, somewhere in there, so that you're at least moving, you know, you want to be like somewhat healthy. When we start to see people in the like 2 range, we know that they're like orienting their life around exercise, that they're like pretty serious at what they're doing. And then when we see people around the 2.5, then we start having the conversation of like, what's your actual limit? And what are the issues you're running into, and how can we like optimize your budget? But yeah, I mean, comparing your metabolism to other people is kind of foolish. And by the way, we don't see differences between male and female metabolism. When you look at the physical activity level leaderboard here at Glorify, half women, half men. Our top physical activity level is a woman. So there's no evidence that men have a faster metabolism or can work harder or whatever. Men do have a faster metabolism simply because they happen to have more lean body mass on average, but they don't have, we don't process fuel in different, you know, fundamentally different ways or whatever. Yeah. So it's actually one of these really interesting findings where we're way more similar than we might think. And your metabolism is just that. It's just your metabolism. It's your gas mileage. It's the rate at which you burn fuel. You would never you know, buy a car without knowing its gas mileage. You would never, you know, start on a road trip without knowing how much gas you have in the tank. And that's what we all of us think we're doing, you know, with our diet and our exercise, is we're just guessing on all of those. We know where we are as a company. We're really new. We have a really expensive product. So, you know, we want to be able to serve more and more people in the future. We understand this might not be for everyone, but this is the only way right now to not guess about those things if you are curious about that aspect of yourself as a person.
Hey, yeah. Ari, I have one more question on the fidgeting side, because I thought that was really interesting.
Wait, real quick, Jay, are you a fidgeter?
Yeah, pretty a lot.
Yeah, because I'm not. So that's also interesting.
Well, I thought it was interesting because, I am a fidgeter. I don't sit still very much, just in general. Like Chad, when I hang out with him or talk to him, he like calms me way down. I like it. But no, and I spend a lot of my day talking as well. Like I spend a lot of time on the phone with athletes, new athletes with Run Free, onboarding them. Now I'm just and I'm just a very very fidgety, you know, I like being on the move. So, but my question is, so Hari, if I wanted to make a change and purposefully not fidget as much and put more energy toward training, would that be a suggestion that you would give? And then conversely, if someone else who wasn't a fidgeter and was more interested in lean body mass, would you suggest them to fidget a little bit more active? Because I was thinking about that on both ends. Like it could work both ways. Is that a recommendation, or is that like a nominal amount of the caloric burn?
Can I add something in real fast too? Also, is that going to happen naturally? Like Jay, if you were training for a marathon, would you naturally stop fidgeting, right? Or just lessen it or something? Or maybe you just can't stop it.
I mean, I know that it does lessen it. It mellows me some, but there's a part of like, that's just who I am that I think, I mean, I couldn't completely stop it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's see here. So there's really only four components of metabolism. You have your BMR. There's one we haven't talked about, which is the thermic effect of food. It takes energy to digest food. So you don't extract all the energy from that. Fats are really efficient. The thermic effect of food there is only about 0 to 3%. So if you eat 100 calories of fat, you get 97 or more calories out of it. Carbs are a little bit less, like 5 or 10%. And then protein is at least 20 to 30% of that energy in the protein goes, you just burn it to digest it. What you're talking about is NEAT, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which is all that other stuff, all the fidgeting, all that stuff. And then finally, there's exercise. So I think, NEAT, I think, does matter. I think it can matter on the order of 1,000 or 1,500 calories a day. Chad, you might remember, I think, didn't Andrew Huberman have a thing about like flexing your soleus, like bouncing your calf up and down and doing like soleus pushups?
Yeah.
How much that could burn or something like that.
Yeah, so it was like 1,000 calories a day or something. And I remember it's funny because I tried to start fidgeting when I heard that because I just wanted to see. I can't do it. Like, I think it's just a personality thing, you know? Like, I can't just remember to fidget all the time. It's just not in my nature.
Yeah, I can't speak to how effective it would be to try, but I think there have been studies where they have, like, manipulated people doing these calf push-ups, essentially, like these flexes. And they had burned a lot of calories. So yeah. But I mean, what do top runners do? You know, they tend to nap, they tend to do a lot of like really, really gentle recovery type stuff, massage. Like, I think there are probably a lot of things that you can do that don't burn that many calories if you are really trying to maximize your training.
Well, there's a saying that says, if you're standing, sit, if you're sitting, lie down, if you're lying down, take a nap.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm trying to think the other question I had with that. I think, again, just to circle back to the difference between Jay and I think this thing you know, regardless of whether you guys take the test or not, is to really consider your lifestyle as a whole, because there's, it's counterintuitive. I think, again, if you just looked at Jay and I's activity level, just from a training perspective, you would get it so wrong, you know? And I think that's what's really cool about getting accurate data, is it can totally change the way that you perceive, like, what's going on, the whole thing, right? Because, like, you might be frustrated not losing weight, and you just don't know that, you know, maybe you're not a fidgeter. Maybe you're like me and you're just more of a calm person. And it's like, you can just kind of recalibrate. And I think it's cool to get accurate data to allow you to really do that.
Hey, I love the data that I got for two reasons. One was, I do think that I want to slide a little more of my energy towards my training. And I was like, hey, that's pretty cool to know numerically what to do. Like, and also the second reason was, I was happy to be able to justify the amount of food that I eat.
Yeah.
And on a serious note, like, that's kind of funny, right? But on a serious note, like, I do eat a lot and often. And it's good to know that, man, I can't dabble with super low caloric, you know, intake if I'm going to be as active as I'm going to be. And for me at this point in my life, man, there's no way I'm going to come home and not play with my kids or not go on the hike or not do the bike ride or not. And so that's a sticky situation to be in, where I think a lot of our athletes, a lot of our run free athletes are probably more in my scenario than Chad's, where you've got all this stuff going on that require caloric needs.
Yeah.
And wow, what a mistake that would be to think I'm going to undercut it and then try to still do all the things that I'm doing. And then on the flip side of that, also to realize, hey, all that other stuff that I'm doing is adding up into that stress level. If I'm going to devote more time to training, I've got to find a way to take away at least some of this fidgeting or some of this activity or something, or I'm not going to have the budget to do it.
Yeah. And the feedback we get from our nutritionist, Joe Butler, about our athletes when she goes over their nutrition is they are chronically under eating and having issues because of that. And I think the ironic thing is that when you have a super active lifestyle like Jay does, right, where you're just very busy, is it becomes harder to eat, right? It's like you almost have to be thinking about it more often. Yeah, you got to plan what you're going to be doing, because now your lifestyle makes it even more difficult. Whereas, you know, I am working from home. I can eat whenever I want to, really. So I think that's something I would say specifically to our athletes is something I've also seen with my, especially my athletes who have jobs that are very active. Sometimes they'll just forget to eat enough, right? And it's like, if you're also, say, doing marathon training and have a very active lifestyle, you might be like at the upper limits of your metabolic range, and you might not even be aware of it, right? And then you're also trying to lose weight in that process. And, you know, that's where you can get in trouble. So, Hari, actually, that's something I wanted to ask you is, when people are not feeling well, because you guys also, one of the metrics you gave us was, you know, sort of, if you're wanting to lose weight, here's like a safe limit of what your calorie range could be. And if you're wanting to gain weight, you gave us all these different numbers that we can shoot for, depending on our goals. So tell us a little bit about, like, what happens if you're maybe operating outside of those. And I think for athletes, typically people are trying to lose weight. So, you know, when you're undershooting that, what will go on with our bodies?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so first off, I totally agree with both of you. I mean, I think it's much more common for athletes to be under fueling than anything else. And I also think that if you are an athlete and you're trying to change your body composition, presumably by that you mean you either want to increase muscle or decrease fat or both, you probably don't want to be as aggressive as our standard boilerplate recommendations that we put in our report. And that's one of the reasons why we meet with everybody who takes our test, is because we want to make sure that we're actually giving them sound advice for who they are and what their goal is. There are certain things that are in our core area of competency, and there are certain things that we're basically, you know, offload and say, hey, we're agnostic to the approach that you want to take, but here's the data to keep you on track. So we do have some standard recommendations in our report. Five different calorie targets for five common goals. One is maintenance, so just eat what you burn. One is gaining weight, which is eating in more than a 10% surplus. And then the other three are kind of more kind of nuanced body composition goals. So one is kind of a build muscle, kind of a lean bulk in bro science, you know, protein shake in world, you know, new parlance. That's about a 10% surplus. There's nothing magical about these numbers, but that's around the right kind of calorie regime to be in to gain mass, but not to gain excess fat along with it. A kind of a recomp, build, burn fat, build some muscle, is a 10% deficit. So just for example, for you, Chad, that's a 250, 300 calorie deficit. So it should be a pretty modest deficit that allows you to do that, especially on these weight lossy type ones. Protein and resistance training are big, big chunks of that too. And I can go into some of those numbers in a second. The last one is maximum safe fat loss, which is a 25% calorie deficit. So for you, Chad, that's about a 700 calorie deficit. That's a lot.
Yeah. And so I mean, we're not.
If you're doing what you're doing, that's reckless, I think. That'd be my hunch as a practitioner. There haven't been good studies of it, but that's a lot. These are pretty bread and butter type recommendations. Just these percentages are things that, you know, you see that are common out there, but there's no like consensus in the literature that this is the way to do it. But the basic theory behind it would be you need to be in a calorie deficit to lose weight. But losing the right type of weight is what you really care about. Whenever anybody says they want to lose weight, what they mean is they want to lose fat. They don't want to lose muscle and preserve fat. And so you need to be in that calorie deficit. The bigger the calorie deficit that you're in, the more you're going to lose. But after a certain point, you're going to lose a lot of lean muscle along with it. And so we want that not to happen. And so that's why we kind of cap it at 25%. Now, I have seen in the literature people getting away with even a 40% deficit and even an increasing lean body mass, but they're eating a ridiculous amount of protein, like 2.2 or 2.4 grams per kilo. So like over a pound, over 1 gram per pound of body weight. So that's a lot.
Yeah.
If you've ever tried to actually stomach that amount of protein, you're probably going to need to use some protein shakes if you need to get that amount down. And they were resistance training a ton. I think for typical like run free listener, you're probably an endurance athlete, probably a runner, like really fine tune deficits and surpluses and let your body just kind of naturally reach that kind of equilibrium through your diet and through your training. Like we can calculate for people if you do have a goal, like if you want to lose half a pound a week or a pound a week or whatever it is, we can calculate that target for you. If you want to reach a certain body fat percentage on a certain goal date and then maintain it, we can do all that math for you. So we can do that. But my hunch would be that most serious-ish runners should probably do much more kind of fine-tuning as opposed to these bigger brute force changes. Like, I don't think it would be a good idea to be training hard and in a 700 calorie deficit, would be my guess. That would just, I don't know. Like, I think you're playing with fire there in terms of injury.
Yeah. And something you'll hear is like set point, right? That people have like maybe a body composition that their body tends towards. Is that something to be aware of? Like, is there a point where our body will, because the whole idea, right, is we have like this metabolic expenditure and our body will adjust accordingly. Does that whole idea of set point play into that?
That's a really interesting concept. I've heard the same thing. I'm not sure is the simple answer there. I'm really not. I do believe that you can kind of blow past it with just basic calorie math. Like the physics are true. Like if you do eat in such and such calorie deficit, you will continue to lose weight and get leaner. But as to whether or not you have a set point or what the best point is for you or what your ideal body composition is or how that varies individually, like, I think those are awesome questions, but just kind of outside my pay grade.
Honestly, I think it'd be hard to measure anyways, because I feel like humans, we're so inaccurate with the way that we go about things, right? It's like most of the time, I think probably the issues people get are trying to do things, like you said, going like that deficit being too high at points, right? So it's like you might be trying too hard at one point and it feels like it's impossible to lose weight, but you're just like going through these fluctuations of not doing it consistently at, you know, a gradual rate over time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So to circle back a little bit, to you guys have been doing these tests for a while. So what have been, I think some of the insights that you've learned from looking at other people, but also I know you've gone on some like crazy adventures and experienced what it's like to be way outside the limits. So you're talking about with that 2.5%. What has been like your own experience with it and kind of some of the more general insights?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, this kind of also speaks to the, kind of the origins of the company. So again, I have this background as a runner and as an endurance athlete. And then after my running career, I turned my focus to my lifelong passion for mountains and alpine climbing in particular. So I like climbing technical routes on snow, rock, and ice in the big mountains. And one discipline that I've really focused on in the last almost 15 years now is high altitude climbing, climbing some of the world's highest mountains without supplemental oxygen. And so through all that, I became more interested in metabolism. And there were a couple things that that interested me. One is kind of like exercise metabolism of high altitude. One of the peculiarities of high altitude, and by high altitude in this case, I'm talking about like over 23,000 feet, like really high.
Yeah.
You basically can't eat, like your digestive system shuts down. And so if you are a very carb dependent athlete, so one of the things I noticed going early, you know, into the Sierra Nevada and stuff like that is I was really fit, you know, straight off an All-American performance. And I couldn't keep up with this guy on, you know, climbing a mountain. It was like a 35-mile run plus some glacier climbing, plus some rock climbing. And like I just kind of got smoked. I bonked. I was like literally crying, like 15 miles from the car. Like, man, this is pretty epic. And what I realized was I was just like highly trained for, you know, much shorter efforts, much higher intensity efforts, and it was much more carbohydrate dependent. And so I tried to train myself as I went into these higher and higher altitudes to become more and more fat adapted, so that I could basically oxidize fat, you know, long, slow fuel out of my, you know, infinite body fat stores, because I simply couldn't do the one gel per hour thing. Like, it's just not possible. And so I started manipulating my training by going on like really long, fasted road bike rides and stuff like that, you know, just coffee and just going, and just electrolytes, long, long hikes, 10, 12 hour days without food. Or if I was going to have food, I would have like hard-boiled eggs, so I wouldn't have carbs.
So are you trying to go into ketosis?
I mean, not necessarily go full keto and go all that far, but just like try to manipulate my metabolism there. Mm. And so what I wanted to do with all this is I wanted to like see how I performed at high altitude metabolically. And so I reached out and talked to Herman Ponser at Duke, our now scientific advisor, and we got set up with some testing. This was in 2021. I went to Manaslu, which is the eighth highest mountain in the world. I ended up summiting, reaching the true summit, which has only been done a few dozen times. And I was the only person to reach it without supplemental oxygen, which has been done very seldom. And so this is I did a test during my last week in California. I was quite sedentary. I was just like literally fattening up before the trip. I'm just eating garbage. And I was like, I burned 2,500 calories. And then I go and there, I trek to base camp. It's about 60 or 70 miles. You start all the way down in the jungle. You go up and over a 17,000 foot pass and all the way around to this base camp. And I was burning like 44 or 4,600 calories, something like that. And then, the summit push for the whole week of the push, I averaged 65, 87. And so that means the summit day was probably close to 15,000 calories or something like that. It was a 19-hour day, hardly any food or water. Maybe I got down and kept down because I did vomit at the end. Probably I got in a total of like 200 calories. I was at a PAL of 3.63 for that whole week, which isn't as high as I would have thought.
Yeah.
Again, Tour de France is 4.9, but you can do more work at low altitude. It's just a fact. Yeah. So high altitude is extreme because you're breathing so hard, but you simply can't do that. You burn that many calories. My heart rate wasn't that high because your heart rate can't go that high. It's weird. Like your resting heart rate goes up and your max heart rate goes down. So they get narrower and narrower and narrower. And that's just the smaller and smaller envelope where you can literally be alive. Mm. When those touch, like that's where you die. Right. So interestingly, on the trip, I lost 11 pounds, which was way better than I'd ever done before. Now, I didn't get any GI sickness, which had happened on a lot of my other trips. My worst trip was Lhotse, the fourth highest mountain in the world. It's connected to Everest. So I did the same day as Everest, except for the summit day. And I lost 25 pounds.
Well, how long was that trip?
That was like 9 weeks.
9 weeks and 25 pounds, man.
Yeah, bad. So I lost 11 pounds, but I got my body composition tested because that's the other thing about our test. We are the best at-home body fat test. There are more accurate ways to do it in the lab, like a DEXA scan, for example, but we're really accurate. I only lost 3 pounds of muscle.
Wow.
And I really credit that to this and supplementing protein in base camp. Crushing calories in base camp, like absolutely shoveling in food whenever I could, like to the point of feeling really, really full always, because you can't eat up on the mountain. I'm so bad at eating on the mountain. And even if you want to, you can't. And I also did mini strength workouts, these little, I would just call them trigger sessions, just like remind my body to hold on to muscle. Just like pick up a rock like this big and just do squats, just do push-ups, pull-ups on the tent. Like, and so I think I really rounded the corner in my understanding of you know what my metabolic needs are at that altitude, and then how to cope with being in that big of a calorie deficit. Because you are in, let's just be honest, it's an unhealthy calorie deficit. Like climbing big mountains is not good for you. So how do I cope with that? I cope with it with protein and I cope with it with strength training. I just got back from, doing part of the Arizona Trail. It goes from Utah to Mexico. And I did about 106 miles in 59 hours. And, again, I brought about 100 grams of protein per full day on the trail. So at least I'm going to have like, not like great amount of protein, but like not a poor amount of protein because I knew I was going to be in a calorie deficit. I only packed 3,000 calories per day. And so I'm like, all right, I'm just going to be hungry for a few days. Let's be honest. I'm just going to shovel food in when I get to Flagstaff. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that big of a deal. Let me just make sure that I get the protein I need to cope with this calorie deficit. So yeah, it's really interesting to kind of use. Oh, and by the way, my calories did bump up. What did they bump up? They bumped up about 900 or 1100 calories a day, something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's interesting. So even in like these huge calorie deficits, the strength training you think is helping you retain muscle mass.
I really do. And that translates over to regular people too. So if you're trying to lose weight, whether or not you want to test with Calorify, make sure that you get the protein in and make sure that you're doing something to tell your body to hold on to that lean body mass, because otherwise you will get lighter, but you might not actually get to the kind of actual goal that you have, which is looking better, feeling better, being leaner.
Yeah, that's cool. Because I feel like sometimes it's like when we're trying to get a principle, it's like the extremes are where things get super far away, right? And you can kind of measure those massive differences. So I think that's a cool thing that, you know, as we're not in as crazy of deficits in our typical training programs, something like the principle like that of like keeping the strength training in there, you know, a big component of
reducing body fat composition as opposed to just losing overall weight, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We don't give macro recommendations formally as part of our product, but I think like one that just needs to be in its own category is protein. Think about it as like something just independent entirely. I know that protein contains calories and it's food, but we just need protein. We also need essential fatty acids, but we need protein. So make sure that you get that amount. The minimum like recommendations that are out there are pathetically low. I think that's like to keep you out of some like disease state, but like what you need to be a healthy person, and certainly what you need as an athlete. I mean, if you think about the amount of load that you're putting on your body when you go run and you're doing these like, you know, single leg squats all day, basically hitting the pavement or whatever it is, like you're going to need more protein than a typical person.
Yeah.
Somewhere I think in the vicinity of like a gram per pound of body weight is like kind of where I try to get to. I usually don't hit it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we, like you're saying, it is kind of in its separate category, right? Because we're using carbohydrates and fats even as fuel sources, whereas protein can be in extreme situations used for fuel, but for the most part, it's more like in muscle repair, right? So it is kind of its own category.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So quick follow-up question on that. How did you feel in that sort of like extreme ranges of like huge calorie deficits? Like, are you feeling good or you just feel like terrible the whole time?
Gosh, I mean, it's so hard. It's really hard to even describe what it's like at 8,000 meters, these 14 mountains in the world that are over 8 kilometers high, 26,000 feet and change. I've done three of them now without oxygen. And I've been on half of them. I've been on Everest K2, all these ones. It's almost like a dreamlike state. It's like you've transcended the bonk and you're just like in this like ethereal world. I mean, I was approaching the summit of Broad Peak, the 12th highest mountain in the world. It's right next to K2. It's in Pakistan. I was taking 12 breaths per step.
Oh, wow.
And the amount, the intensity of the breathing would be like harder than a threshold pace, but the heart rate would be lower than easy pace because you simply can't access the higher zones. And so everything is pure like zone one aerobic. Like there's no point in training higher intensities in the super high mountains because you can't possibly access those heart rate zones anyhow. There's simply not enough oxygen to do that. So it feels like you're doing like extraordinarily hard running work and you're just sustaining that all the time. I mean, the highest I've ever camped was 25,700 feet on Lhotse, like literally Mount Everest. It's the third highest campsite in the world. And I went fully anaerobic putting my boots on, and it took about 20 minutes to put my boots on. Like every time I tried to push my foot into my boot, it was like the end of an all-out quarter. So it's super, super, super hard. It's also unbelievably rewarding. It's kind of like an entire season because these mountains take a couple months to climb. And so it's like everything that goes into preparing for states or for nationals or whatever it is, all wrapped up into one like big, you know, summit day. If you even get the privilege of making it to summit day, and all season, you have to do every workout. You have to complete the workout. Like if today's 12 by a quarter and you make it to 8 and you want to quit, like too bad. Like you literally can't quit. You either have to do the 12 or you have to go all the way back down to the previous camp where you were to quit. Like in Pakistan, to quit, you have to walk 70 miles out.
Oh my gosh.
So like, it's really just a lot of emotion wrapped up into it. It's an incredible cultural experience. It's very intense, like bonding experience with all of your team members. It's an incredible experience with nature. It is extremely dangerous. And I've had a number of like very close calls in the high mountains where, you know, you realize just how fragile your life is and, you know, you see other people die and all that kind of stuff. And then you do get these like truly extraordinary, like transcendent days where you get the opportunity to be in a place that like, it's hard to describe. Hardly anybody has ever been there. And it's just, I mean, it's like you're fully detached from the rest of the world. It really, really is special when it all works out. So it takes a lot of my passion for running, but it also kind of connects me to the world in a different way that I really, really like. And it's something that I can still do post running. Like I can go for a run right now, but I really can't train. And so the mountains are a great way for me to be able to be active. I love trekking. I love hiking. And I love technical alpine climbing. So yeah, there's just a lot of, my whole life kind of wrapped up into it.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. I mean, I think this has been such a cool conversation, just thinking about, you know, our bodies are so dynamic, and the way that we expend our calories and how you distribute those can vary in such high degrees, whether it be going in extreme deficits in short periods of time, or these treks or grand tours, or like the long-term sustainable way that we go about it. And I think for me, you know, I think one of the things that I'm going to take away from the Chlorify test and introducing my training is getting more towards that 2.5% burn rate, right? And making that more of a sustainable, not having these huge days where I'm maybe outside of those limits. But I think it's also cool to contrast that with your experiences in the high mountains where you're going way outside those ranges, right? And your body is okay, you know, doing that for periods of time.
Absolutely. And that's something we want to learn more and more about is, can you overreach? How much can you overreach? Is overreaching good? And then when do you need to drop back? Like, we know that these mountain trips, for example, are overreaching. We know that the Tour de France is overreaching. So we know that humans are capable of doing like extraordinary things over, you know, multi-day periods that are well outside of the bounds of what you can sustain. And so I think the question there, especially if you're interested in more kind of ultra distance type stuff, or if you're interested in some of these outdoor type sports like the long distance backpacking or mountaineering or other activities that really require rowing across the Atlantic, these kinds of activities that have been measured with this method, like those are really cool applications of this science and this technology as well. But I think for regular endurance athletes that are interested in distances up to the marathon, I think those like are really useful concepts as well, that I hope that we can make some real contributions there. Like, you know, how and when should you overreach in your cycle?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's going to be I'm excited to keep following along with you guys and kind of how your knowledge base develops. So to kind of start wrapping things up here, who is this test for? Like who do you think is going to get the most benefit out of taking the Chlorify test?
Yeah, I think it's a few groups. We certainly would love if everyone took it. We know that it's at a very high price point. It's $1,000 on the website. We will offer a big discount to all of your audience. Use code RUNFREE at checkout at chlorify.com for $700. Also, if you have a team or a group or some other kind of cohort that you'd like, maybe group pricing or anything like that on, just reach out. Hari at Chlorify, H-A-R-I at chlorify.com. John at chlorify.com or support at chlorify.com, and we will work with you there for sure. But we know that that's not the typical thing. I mean, that's more than a VO2 max test cost or a bunch of other things that other people might have held back on already. So I think it's really useful for a few different groups of people to get started. One is, let's say that you've got an issue that you, for whatever reason, have been stuck on. It could be your body composition. It could be a pattern of overuse injuries, just something that, or just simply determining your fueling needs that you really haven't been able to, you know, figure this out. If there is a question like that you haven't been able to answer, I think we will get to the bottom of it with you. Chlorify is not magic. You still have to do all the hard work yourself, but we can pretty much guarantee that you're not going to make major mistakes once you have this information. We will put you in the right direction and follow up with you, and we will create a custom plan with you. So if you are a runner looking to improve your body composition, if you're looking to monitor your training level, especially if you think you might be near a limit, or if you feel like you've been injury prone and can't figure out why, we might be able to help you get to the bottom of that.
Very cool. Yeah. And like we talked about, you know, I think I was kind of surprised at like getting some of the number backs, getting some insight. And honestly, like comparing it with Jay's data, it was also like really cool for me to kind of see how somebody else's numbers stack up too. And hopefully if you guys do take the test, you know, you now have the information of what Jay's test looks like, what my test looks like. So you can kind of get a little bit of some data points to compare and contrast with. Jay, what did you feel like were the big takeaways from you from your test?
I feel like two things. One was that my activity level is pretty high in terms of non-running stuff, and that there is potential there to adjust and shift those things during different seasons of my life. Also, I was just, I kind of assumed that Chad would burn more calories than I would, right?
Me too.
We're all disappointed at my burn rate.
I think now, like hearing that, and like it just reinforces like the thought and the idea that everybody is different, and you can't make outside assumptions without knowing the inside knowledge, right? Like that's always a mistake, to like just assume that you know something without actually having the data. And I mean, I'm, you know, my degree is in exercise science. I've done tons of VO2 maxes and lactate threshold tests. And man, I'm just a nerd for all those types of data points. And I love learning and like filling gaps where my knowledge is lacking. So that's the huge takeaway for me, is just to continue as a coach, and like as a, I mean, I'm an athlete, but I'm really a coach at my heart, because a lot of the stuff I do, I experiment on myself to become a better coach. Like that's really a lot of my motivation. So I'm hugely thankful, Hari, for the opportunity and for the knowledge to just be able to expand and hopefully be able to help somebody else out in the future that maybe has similar questions and be able to have somewhere to point them.
Yeah. And quick note there too, is if you're a Run Free athlete and you do take the Calorify test, and I will definitely, you know, there's definitely specific athletes that I have that I think it would be very useful for, make sure to share it with your coach. Cause I think that's another thing that is cool to see. It's like, I'm familiar with Jay, so I know that you're a pretty active guy, right? I could guess that you're probably burning a lot of calories, but we don't really get in-person time with our athletes seeing their day-to-day life. So that's a lot of insight for a coach to kind of get a good gauge of what does your lifestyle look like? Because that also just gives us an idea of what your expenditure is, like energy-wise too, because, you know, there's limitations on just how much time and energy you have for training. So definitely share that information. Another thing, one last thing I wanted to bring up is kind of, you are choosing a week to do it. And Hari, you and I talked about different ways in which you can utilize the test to look at, say, like maybe your base training phase. Maybe you want to get a sample marathon week if you're doing marathon builds. So what would be your suggestion in terms of picking a good week as a sample?
First of all, it doesn't have to be a week. We choose a week because we feel like most of our customers do different things on weekdays and weekends. If you're on a 10-day cycle or some other training plan, we can work around that. So we can do this in any way that makes the most sense for you. We can do as few as 4 or 5 days. And if you need significantly longer than a week, we need to know that so that you get enough water. But we can work around you. It's just that 7 is a pretty typical number for a lot of the people that we see. So I would say pick a week that would be you know, representative of what you're going to be doing for that phase. Because we know it's an expensive test, you might not want to do it all that frequently. So maybe it's somewhere at the beginning of your summer base phase where, you know, you're going to be doing that type of work, you know, for the next couple months or whatever. So hit a block at the beginning of that, and that'll dial in your nutritional needs and your activity level and body composition and all that kind of stuff for that phase. And then maybe revisit it when you, you know, get in season and you're doing more intervals and more high intensity work or whatever it is. The other kind of idea would be that if you do have some other plan, like say that you are actually changing your body composition pretty significantly, we might want to retest as you know, you progress on that glide slope to keep you on track. A lot of people go down and then they plateau, or they maybe overshoot and then they yo-yo out of it. And we don't want to have you make any of those errors. So the best thing we can do in that case is to periodically retest. The most frequently, I think a typical athlete would want to retest would be maybe monthly. And again, we're not, you know, requiring that you do that. It's really kind of up to you. If you just also want to spot check and learn a little bit more about your body, the one-off test is no problem either. It's totally up to you and how you want to use this information about yourself.
Awesome. Cool stuff. Well, Hari, thanks for coming on. And again, we'll put the link to the Chlorify test in the description along with that code to get you guys a discount. But yeah, thanks again for coming on, and thanks for giving us the test. Like it was super good insight, and I'm excited to apply some of those things.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Thanks for your service to the running community. I'm really a big fan of the podcast and what you guys do.